And now it's my pleasure to introduce to you our speaker for this morning, Hina Khan Mukhtar. Did I get that right? Hina is one of the founders of a homeschooling cooperative in Lafayette, California. It serves over 35 families in the East Bay. And besides teaching language arts to K to 12 students, she's involved in interfaith dialogue. And some of you I know have heard her speak recently at a panel at the library in Castro Valley. Many of us were here because of the memorial service for Doug Sprague at that time, so we missed this event. But that organization, that fledgling organization, the Eden Interfaith Council, will be having many other panels and public forums and activities. So we look forward to this new interfaith cooperation. Hina is a monthly contributor to the Muslim Observer's Raising Our Ummah column, and then she also shares parenting advice and ideas for nurturing childhood spiritual traditions for another publication called Seeker's Hub. And Hina has graciously agreed to come back after some time for coffee this morning to have a conversation with all of you. So now I would like to present our speaker, Hina Khan Mukhtar.
Thank you very much for inviting me today. I'm really impressed you guys made it out on Super Bowl Sunday. My husband usually comes out with me to all our interfaith gatherings, but today Super Bowl took precedence. So I'll just start with Bismillah Rahman Rahim. I begin in the name of God, most gracious, most merciful. I don't have anything prepared. I thought we were going to be having a Q&A session up here. So I just wanted to tell you a little bit about myself and how I got into interfaith work. It's basically, religion is a really private thing for so many people, and it's really hard to get out there. And I'm not somebody who proselytizes or goes out and tells people they should be converting to my faith or that they need to know the truth. But what's been happening lately is there's a lot of misconceptions out there, and people think they know the truth about what I believe and what I think and what members of my community believe and think. And so we've been kind of forced to come out of our comfort zones and be willing to speak about what's really going on with us and in our communities. And so I'm very, very appreciative when somebody invites us and says, can you come answer some questions? Can we find out a little bit about how you guys are feeling these days and what we can do to help? And unfortunately, this gets born out of tragedy, like what happened in Paris and what happened in San Bernardino. It's my son's in public high school, and he also recently has been having to answer a lot of questions. It's a silver lining. The truth is it's forcing Muslims to organize. It's forcing Muslims to really think about what they believe and what they don't believe and what's important to share with everybody. So just a little bit about the Muslim community. We're definitely hurting right now. Everybody's scared and feeling anxious, and we've seen the beauty of our country, the most beautiful aspects of it come out, and some of the ugliest aspects of it come out as well. The first community that reached out to us was the Japanese American community. They immediately were like, we're here for you. We're not going to let it happen again. I know many people in my community are already thinking about exit plans, that where do we go if Trump gets elected, and really wondering about it's not a joke anymore. Trump's no longer a joke. And for a while, everybody was laughing. And I actually thought he was one day going to say, surprise, this was a joke the whole time. I just wanted to show you guys how far down this path I could take you. But now I'm thinking he's actually pretty sincere in his delusion. And so people are asking a lot of questions like, how did the Jews who got out of Europe in time know when to leave, and what were the signs on the wall? And so, and my parents recently, it broke my heart. My parents immigrated to America in the 1960s. My mom recently said at the breakfast table, you know, we thought that we had done all the hard work and we had done all the suffering and the assimilation and the fitting in so that our children's lives could be easier here. And we never thought that for our grandchildren, there'd be a whole new set of worries, you know. So that's one fear. Another fear is how to get our kids to have faith and have confidence in who they are and pride in who they are and to not be apologetic and not to have to feel like they have to explain what's happening in the far corners of the world in countries that they've never even visited, people they don't even know, policies that have nothing to do with them, governments that they did not elect. But they're having to answer for all those actions over here in their high schools and junior high schools. And so there's, you know, our nightly conversations are about how to have that pride. And the way I've been dealing with it is really just kind of tuning out the media. I have to know what's going on in the world, especially because of my interfaith work and the questions that I get asked. But as far as my family's concerned, we're turning off the news. We're trying to make our home a beautiful, peaceful space. I say that I'm kind of leading my kids out of the storm and taking them to the center of the vortex and really giving them an environment where they feel that they are safe and that their religion is beautiful and that it does confirm all of the American ideals that they're taught in school, that there's nothing different from what they're taught in their homes. And that's pretty much how everybody in my community has been responding. So I guess that's just, I didn't know how long you wanted me to speak, but I think during...
As long as you want to.
Yeah, so that's pretty much about it. I guess during Q&A we can answer any specific questions you have, and there's no question that will offend me. Yeah, I'm here I can't guarantee that my answers won't always be what you want to hear, but no question is off the table. You can ask me what we believe, and obviously I'm one person. I don't speak for the entire Muslim world, but I have my finger on the pulse of what's going on with the Muslim community here in the Bay Area. I'm involved in a lot of different groups, and so I can give you a good idea of where your Muslim neighbors stand on different issues with you. So we can talk later. Yeah. Questions now? Or now?
I was thinking that since Hannah thought that this would be the question and answer,
yeah,
let's make it that.
Yeah.
And would you like to sit in front or are you?
I'm fine standing.
Okay.
This is fine, yeah.
All right. So if you have questions.
Yeah. Well, oh, for the audience members.
For the audience,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we'll get
I can do
Stuart to play Troy Donahue or something.
For those of a certain age.
Just don't be Jerry Springer, that's all.
A lot of people always wonder, what do Unitarian Universalists believe? And so we've come up with some principles, mm-hmm, to help us out. Could you maybe tell us some principles?
Oh, of the Islamic faith? Sure. So I'll just quickly go through a story that kind of sums up our religion in a nutshell. This is something, I mean, I say story, so people tend to think fiction, but we don't believe this is fiction. We believe this, you know, actually happened. So what the story goes is that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was sitting with his companions in a circle, and when all of a sudden a man appeared to them, and this was a man who was wearing a long white gown, and he had jet black hair, and nobody knew who he was. And the reason that is so notable is because they were in the desert, and if you don't know somebody, that means they're a traveler, and they've been traveling through the desert. But this man had no signs of traveling on him. His hair was jet black, his gown was white, no sign of dust on him. And this man came and sat down in front of the Prophet Muhammad, and he pressed his knees up against his knees, and he said, Muhammad, tell me, what is Islam? And Prophet Muhammad responded that Islam is to testify that there's only one God and that Muhammad is the messenger of God. It is to pray 5 times a day. It is to fast in the month of Ramadan. It is to give 2.5% of your savings every year in charity. And it's to go on Hajj, the pilgrimage, to the holy cities at least once in your life if you're able. And the man responded, "You're correct." So the companions who were sitting there were completely shocked. They were like, "Who is this man who's asking the question and then confirming the answer?" But they didn't interrupt. So then the stranger asked, "Muhammad, tell me, what is iman," which means faith. So Islam means submission, iman means faith. So the Prophet Muhammad responded, "Iman is to believe in one God. It's to believe in the prophets, Noah, starting from Adam, all the biblical prophets, you know, Noah and Joseph and Jacob and Abraham and Jesus and Moses. It's to believe in the revealed books, the Torah and the Gospels and the Psalms. It is to believe in the angels, that they exist. It's to believe in the Day of Judgment, that it's coming. It's to believe in the will of God, which is that what hits you was never going to miss and what misses you was never going to hit. And it's to believe in the final hour, that this world will end at some point, this earthly world." And the man responded, "You're correct." And again, the disciples were surprised by the fact that he was confirming the answer after asking the question. Then he said, "Tell me, what is ihsan," which means excellence or beauty. And Prophet Muhammad responded, "It is to worship your Lord as if you see him, and if you see him not, to know that he sees you." And he said, "You're correct." Then he said, "Tell me about the hour," meaning tell me when is the end of time coming. And Prophet Muhammad responded, "The one being asked the question doesn't know any more than the one asking the question." And he said, "Okay, then tell me some of the signs of the hour." And so the Prophet Muhammad went through some signs of the end of time that I won't go into right now. And the man responded, "You're correct." Then after a while, the stranger got up and he left. So everybody sat there in silence. And then finally, Prophet Muhammad turned to the companion on his right. And he said, "Umar, do you know who that was?" And he responded, "Only Allah." Allah is the Arabic word for God. "Only Allah and his messenger know the answer to that question." And he said, "That was Gabriel. He came to teach you your religion." And around 80, there's some conflict of whether it was 60 days or 80 days, but somewhere between 60 and 80 days after this incident, the Prophet Muhammad passed away. So this hadith, this experience from the life of the Prophet Muhammad, is considered to be our religion in a nutshell. And it's considered to be very important because it was so close to the end of his life. So when he described Islam, which is submission, that is everything that we do with our bodies. So when we pray, it's a physical act that you see. When we give charity, it's a physical act. You see us give charity. When we fast, that's a physical act. When we say the testimony of faith, you say that with your tongue. It's a physical act. So that's all what we are going on the Hajj, the pilgrimage, that's physical. So that whole thing is with the body. The second question about what is iman, faith, that has everything to do with the mind, what we believe. So I can say I believe in Jesus and Moses, but I don't believe in Abraham, and that actually takes me outside of Islam. Or I can say, yeah, I believe in the Quran and the Torah, but I don't believe in the Bible. That takes me out of Islam. So I have to believe in all the revealed books. I can say I believe in the Day of Judgment, I believe in the prophets, I believe in the revealed books, but I'm not convinced that angels exist. That actually takes me out of Islam. These are all the articles of faith of what we believe with our minds that are taught in our Sunday schools to our children so that they know what their creed is, what they believe. Then the last part, what is excellence, what is ihsan, it's to see your Lord, it's to worship your Lord as if you see him, and if you don't see him, to know that he sees you. That's, from that we get Sufism. That's the soul. So we've got the body, the mind, and the soul, the heart. And so when it comes to the body, we have the science of Sharia. Those are our laws that dictate our day-to-day lives, like how we dress, how we don't dress, what we eat, what we don't eat, how we worship. That's where Sharia comes from. Then from the second point, which is iman, from that we get aqidah, which is our creed, what we believe. And then from the third, the highest level, ihsan, beauty and excellence, from that we get the science of Sufism. So there'll be some people now you'll meet and they'll say, "I'm a Sufi. I'm not a Muslim, but I'm a Sufi." Muslims don't understand that because Sufism is actually a very crucial part of religion. And what we're seeing in the world now, like with movements like Wahhabism, they will focus on the physical, like everything about how you look and how you pray and what you believe, but they completely neglect the part of a religion that talks about beauty and that talks about spirituality. That's where you get poetry from. That's where you get music from. That's where you get art from. And so you see what's happening in the world today. And then we've got some elements where it's all about loosey-goosey, just love and spirituality and poetry, but I don't want to have to do any of the work. This is within the Muslim community I'm talking about. You know, I don't want to have to pray five times a day. I don't want to have to fast. But, you know, give me the art. So that's another element which is seen as another extreme. So Muslims are taught by the Prophet Muhammad to wear the two sandals of hope and fear. Hope in God's mercy and fear or awe of his majesty and of his justice. And so if you wear those two sandals, then you're on the middle path. But if you're all about hope and you don't have any sense of awe or any sense of awareness that we're answerable to God, then you go to one extreme. And if you're all about fear, 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 then you go to another extreme, which we're seeing in the world. But if you wear the two sandals of hope and fear, then you're on the middle path. But that's like a quick short primer, but this is taught throughout the years of Sunday school and to our kids. This is a lifelong journey of learning all those different sciences. But that's what, in a nutshell. Sure.
I would like to ask a question that I read a little bit about is when a man and a woman, Muslims, have a child, mm-hmm. There's something that the man whispers in the child's ear. Mm-hmm. I think for girls once and for boys twice, if I'm not mistaken.
No, it's the same. But you're right. It is whispered in the baby's
so
ears.
Can you explain what exactly they whisper in their ears? And is this something that is supposed to stay with the child for the rest of his life?
Uh-huh.
And how would that have been a Unitarian Universalist? How does that affect their free will living? Mm-hmm. I mean, their choice?
Well, what it is basically what the man whispers in the baby's ears is the call to prayer. And the call to prayer is basically come to prayer, come to prayer, come to success, come to success. There's only one God. Muhammad is a messenger of God. Basically, it's our call to prayer that is sung from the minarets. And if you go to a Muslim country, you'll hear the prayer call being given from the mosques. So when the prayer call is given, very quickly after that, the people assemble for the congregational prayer. It's the understanding is that there's not much time to waste between the prayer call and the prayer itself. So what's interesting is the prayer call is given in the baby's ear, but there's no prayer for the prayer call, just the prayer call. The prayer happens when you die. And the only prayer that we have that doesn't have a call to prayer at that time is the prayer that's done at our funerals. So the understanding is even if you live to be 100, the call to prayer given for your funeral prayer was given at your birth. And so the analogy is that your life actually is really only the span between the call to prayer and prayer. It's that quick. It's that short. And so my best friend's baby was born the other day, and I saw her son, you know, her husband, give the call to prayer in his ear. And we were reflecting on that, on how the prayer for this call to prayer will be given at his death. Oh, and I'm sorry, and there's no effect on free will. We believe in free will, and this has no effect on that.
Yeah. Are you or your children harassed because of your faith these days?
It's really sad. When I tell people in interfaith audiences about the few things we have experienced, I realize how it's become so normal for us. But when I see people's reactions, I realize, no, this isn't normal, and people aren't experiencing this on a daily basis. But things like it's become very, very common if you wear the headscarf that at some point someone's going to look at you and go like that. Yeah, that's very normal. And you just have to keep driving and act like you didn't see it. And, I had a friend who, when she was taking the exit in San Ramon, somebody stopped and went like that to her, you know. And it's happened in Lafayette, it's happened in San Ramon, it happens amongst educated populations. So now pretty much like I was at an event last night at 10:30 at the Santa Ramon Marriott, and one of my girlfriends had come alone, and she would not leave until my husband could escort her to the parking lot. So that's become very normal. I used to have no problem going to fill up my gas at midnight, but now it's like unthinkable that a Muslim woman would go out that late at night on her own, unfortunately. And my biggest fear is about being harassed, because this is a whole new aspect of parenting that I'm coming to that I never thought I would have to confront. And my heart goes out to like Palestinian mothers and African American mothers, because they've experienced this for a long time. But really, the idea of me being harassed in the presence of my sons, who are now teenagers, and really worried about. I've been talking to them a lot about hypothetical situations. That if this happens, how are you going to respond? Because I don't want them to respond illegally. B, I don't want them to do anything that's bad for their own souls or what we've taught them in their faith. I recently had a talk with my son because he shut up a guy in his high school who was being. Basically, he was saying, "Are you here to kill all infidels?" and giving him a real hard time. And my son finally responded in a way that shut the guy up and actually made him apologize, but he used language that we would never condone. And so when I talked to him about that, he said, "Mama, you don't get it." He's like, if that's the only language people understand, and if you don't use it, they don't respect you. And I told him, I do get it. I went to high school here. I do understand that. I don't expect you to be holier than thou. I don't expect you to be getting up and giving sermons. I know you're not a prophet. But all these stories of the prophets that we've taught you your whole life about how they dealt, like the story about Jesus and how he dealt with people cursing him, those weren't fairy tales. Those weren't like fictional stories that we just are telling you of the ancients that, oh, how nice back then. Those are actual examples for you to learn from. And those people are your teachers, not the kids in your high school. And so, you know, really talking to them about how can you avoid losing your sense of self and who you are and what you've been taught and what you know the difference between right and wrong is. So these are the conversations happening at the dinner table now, and I'm hopeful that the next time he will be able to respond with more patience and more in line of how our Prophet Muhammad responded when people cursed him and reviled him and taunted him. So,
Given the atmosphere that you're dealing with now, is there a tendency also to perhaps overreact in the sense that maybe you would have two or three American flags out around your house just to show that you're really American, you're really arrived?
Yeah, we know of somebody who she went on Fox News. She spoke on. I think it was to Megyn Kelly and somebody else who was, you know, being really, it was Trump's spokesperson. So it was Trump's spokesperson debating this Muslim woman who wears the headscarf. Her headscarf was the American flag. I was like, wow, she is like really clearly trying to give a message that, you know, there's, in case you guys have any doubts, you know, so she had the American flag on her head. So, you know, and somebody's like, that's so disrespectful, these Muslims wearing the American headscarf, you know, the American flag as a headscarf. It's like, you sell the American flag as a bikini. You sell it as underwear. I mean, seriously, a headscarf is going to be disrespectful? Like, you know, I've seen it myself. And when I see it, I feel that as an American citizen. I'm like, what are the Stars and Stripes doing on underwear? I don't, you know, it's just, but anyway, so it's, yeah. So some people, yeah, definitely. But, you know, that's the sad part. I have to say, the American flag to me was always growing up, because I actually grew up in Saudi Arabia. My father is an engineer, and so he worked for Parsons, and my father-in-law worked for Bechtel in San Francisco, and both of them got transferred to Saudi Arabia to work on a big oil refinery project there. So we were there as American citizens. I grew up going to an American school, living in an American community, expat community in Saudi Arabia. Unfortunately, never learned Arabic, just completely. It felt like a very American upbringing there. But to me, every time I saw the American flag, I just felt a sense of pride. It was a sense of home. It stood for so many values. Now when a truck passes by me and it's got all these American flags on it, I get scared. I get scared. I don't know what type of person is behind the wheel. And usually it is the person who goes like that, you know? So it's really, it's sad how our flag has been co-opted.
So I hear a lot of beauty in the Muslim religion. I thank you for that. I had an interesting thing happen, sort of related to parenting, I guess you could say. Just last week, in fact, I was walking across the street in Oakland, and there was a car full of four young people, and there was a lot of pot smoke coming out of the window, and the girl driving had the hijab. Is that what
hijab?
Hijab, mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. She was wearing that. Mm-hmm. And they were being very rebellious, mm-hmm. and she punched the gas and spun the tires and just missed me by about a foot. I'm fine, you know. Mm-hmm. But it just made me think a little bit. You know, you're going to have a lot of rebellious people, mm-hmm. like especially younger people in your families. And mm-hmm. have you thought about, you know, how they're going to respond to this this threat against Muslims? And just your thoughts on that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I have a friend who, she's white, you know, blonde, blue-eyed, and her husband's Korean-American, and they're Muslim. They converted, and they've raised their seven children as Muslims. And their kids believe and have no doubt about their faith, but it's very easy for them to slip under the radar because they don't look traditionally Muslim, and their names don't sound, you know, Muslim. And so they've said things like, oh, if I can avoid telling people I'm Muslim, I'm totally going to avoid that, you know, and which really worries their parents because with young people, there is this desire to want to go under the radar. Kids in general don't want to be noticed, don't want to be humiliated, don't want to be pointed out. Like I realized later, I should not have put those little girls on the spot asking them questions during storytelling because that's the truth about, you know, about kids. And so, yeah, that is something that the Muslim community is grappling with and thinking a lot about. And and based, just like with any community, based on how the families are dealing with their children, you're going to see the whole spectrum: rebellion, acceptance, pride, confidence, anger, you know. So.
Greetings. My name is Michael. I was told the highest value in Christianity is compassion, mm-hmm. and the highest value in Islam is justice. Mm-hmm. And that's part of my question. And I want to know if Wahhabism is growing, what percentage of the Muslim world is Wahhabi, mm-hmm. and kind of where did it come from?
So the history of Wahhabism, it's interesting. Wahhabism's not that old. It like came out in the 1800s. I think it started maybe late 1700s and then grew. It's from this one family, the Saud family, that then later took over Saudi Arabia. Wahhabism is basically an after effect of the Muslim, the Ottoman Empire breaking up. And then the Muslim world didn't have a caliphate. We didn't have like one place to go from where, you know, when people say who speaks for the Muslims, there's no one who speaks for the Muslims anymore. And so when the Ottoman Empire was dismantled by the colonialists, by the West in the 1920s, then different movements came up to fill the voids. And Wahhabism is one of them. Unfortunately, Saudi Arabia, you know, they have a lot of money. And the phenomenon of the petrodollar. And so they've been able to buy up a lot of the publishing houses, the traditional publishing houses. If you want to have a mosque built, you know, it's pretty expensive. And the Saudi government will often be willing to fund a mosque being built. But their condition for having a mosque built is that you have to have the imam be somebody from their philosophy, which is the Wahhabi philosophy. That's why a lot of mosques are very, very simple. They're not, you know, anything grand because it's just created by local communities. And so Wahhabism has spread around the globe. I've seen the effect it's had on Pakistan, the country my parents come from. But there's definitely a pushback. Even in America, there's a lot of the youth, a lot of people are very, very attracted to the Sufi element, the highest element of Islam, which the Wahhabis ignore. And so there's a lot of hope for the future, and a lot of dynamic teachers and scholars who are teaching about Sufism and teaching the community that there is it is possible to have a balance between all three. And so your question was, how far has Wahhabism spread? I actually don't know the statistics, but it is Wahhabism is pretty common in the Muslim world. I don't want people to think that all Wahhabis are terrorists. That's not what it is. Wahhabis are generally, because I have Wahhabis in my family, they don't condone violence. They are just very black and white and very by the book and very judgmental. That's a very common attribute of Wahhabis that I see over and over again, and very focused on what others are doing rather than looking at themselves. And so, and I'm, you know, I've been told that those people exist in all religious communities. So that's, you know, that's who we're grappling with. But yeah, I wouldn't want anyone to take away from what I'm saying that all Wahhabis are terrorists, and that if you meet a Wahhabi, you have to be scared. It's that's not what I want to say at all. But it is a philosophy out there that. It is fundamentalist, yeah, because they're about all just the fundamentals and not about any of the nuances, you know?
How many Muslims are there? How many more Muslims than Christians?
Oh, I don't think we're more than Christians, but there's 1.7 billion, they say, in the world right now. We're quarter of the world's population.
Given the state of the Near East or the Middle East, mm-hmm. I would like, because I think our American view of history doesn't go back far enough, mm-hmm. I would like, if you could, to kind of go over the relationship between Muslims and Jews throughout the centuries up to and including the Spanish Inquisition.
Mm. Yeah. Well, you're going to have to pay me to answer that one. No, I do. No, and I really appreciate the question as well. Yeah, Muslims and Jews, this whole idea about Muslims and Jews supposedly hating each other, it's a very, very new phenomenon. And it's got a lot to do with what's happening in with Palestine and Israel right now. So it's pretty much after World War II. Before that, you know, Christians and Jews have always been referred to by the Muslims as the people of the book, and considered to be people with valid traditions, with valid prophets. And the Spanish Inquisition, we often hear about, you know, that the Jews were kicked out. That's what I learned in school, that the Jews were kicked out of Spain. I was an adult when I found out that the Muslims were kicked out as well. I didn't realize that Muslims and Jews together were kicked out of Spain, and many of the Jews fled to Muslim countries. Those Jewish communities exist even today, like in Morocco, around at the tip of Africa. And Maimonides, one of the most famous Jewish scholars of all time, he did his work under Muslims. He lived in Spain. And so it's been a very respectful relationship. Mashallah, I'm using Arabic terms. Mashallah means whenever we compliment something or say something positive, we say mashallah, meaning by the will of God. And whatever even hints of what somebody would label anti-Semitism I've ever heard in the Muslim community, it usually comes from a position of like anger about what's happening in Israel. And then when you remind people what our core beliefs are, and the same thing that not all Jews believe this, or not all, you know, Christians support the kind of Zionism and settlements that are happening right now in Palestine, then people are like, yeah, that's true, you know? But what's happening in Palestine right now is this, like, open, festering wound right now that's just not being healed. And, that's about it.
Islam has a deep history with science. Christianity has come into conflict with science many times when people of faith believe that science is confronting or threatening their position. Mm-hmm. So much, you know, the world is flat, mm-hmm. and now we have now we have people with about evolution. Mm-hmm. Does Islam have this same sort of problem, and how do you deal with that personally?
Growing up, I've never felt a conflict between science and Islam. Even evolution is taught up to a certain point. I mean, we believe that Adam was created in a full human form, the prophet Adam, but Islam doesn't have a problem with evolution as far as like, oh, if you believe in evolution, then that takes you out of Islam. And I don't know what the official position is what the Muslim scholars have decided, but I know what I've been taught is that wherever the religion confirms what science is discovering, then they're considered in harmony. And so far, evolution and you know, the world being flat and all that, is a lot of what the science work that happened during the Renaissance that came out after the Dark Ages came from the work of the Muslim scientists and scholars. So I personally have never felt that conflict. So I haven't looked deeper into it. Like, it's never been like, oh, I have to believe this because Islam is telling me this, but my science teacher is teaching me something else.
It becomes such a problem in this country that some Christians just really don't like science.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, like it's unfortunate because I know a lot of Muslims feel like the opinions they have are just they're kind of in the middle, but unfortunately our voices are pretty silent. You don't really hear, like, even the debate on abortion. Like, Islam doesn't say that abortion is completely not allowed. Abortion is allowed up until 120 days. And if it's considered to be, like, as a form of birth control, then it is considered a sin. But it doesn't, it's not like, that it takes you out of the religion or you're, like, condemned to hell, but it's considered something displeasing to God. But up until 120 days, it's not, we don't consider that the fetus actually has a soul. After 120 days in the womb, we're told that the angels blow the spirit into the fetus, into the baby. And when it comes to things like, you know, rape and wartime crimes, then it's considered acceptable in the first 120 days to have abortion. So it's not black and white. So it's interesting because I've heard from people that it's either or.
In many of our mainstream religions, we have there's a hierarchy of there's a governing group, there's a seminaries to teach ministers and what have you who are assigned to churches. What is the organizing principle of a mosque? And mm-hmm. I understand it's slightly different, and so. But I'm a little confused about how the larger religion filters down to the individual mosque.
Okay. So we don't have clergy in Islam. I know the Shias do. I'm Sunni, so which is the majority. So I believe the Shias do have a clergy, but so we don't have anyone like the Pope or any one place from where the knowledge is being disseminated. What it is we do have traditional scholars who do study the sacred sciences. And one of the biggest tragedies of when the Ottoman Empire was, broken apart is that we lost a lot of our higher institutions of learning. And many of the institutions of learning, universities that had been around for centuries and centuries and centuries, and they're still there, but then other philosophies invaded, like Orientalism or Wahhabism. So Muslims have to figure out where they're going to be getting their knowledge from. So what I've been taught and what I follow is that we get our knowledge from traditional scholars and scholars who have a direct line of not lineage by blood, but a direct line of connection back to the Prophet Muhammad, meaning they learned from a teacher who learned from a teacher who learned from a teacher. And just like you can have a family tree showing who you're related to, people have these trees that show who they got their knowledge from, going all the way back to the Prophet Muhammad, which is really interesting because the whole idea of the diploma system that we have in the West is actually taken from the Muslim world, the black gowns and the turban, what we used to have turbans with a tassel on it, because in the Quran, God says, he says the forefront, he calls it the forelock, and he talks about how this is the part of the brain, basically, where people tell lies or know the difference between right and wrong. So God says in the Quran that he'll grab you by your forelock and ask you basically like why you told lies while you were on earth. So our scholars used to wear these turbans with this tassel to remind them of that line, that God is going to hold me accountable for what I'm teaching. Now in universities and high schools, we do the whole flipping of the tassel and people don't even know where that comes from. The black gowns, those are gowns from the Muslim world that the judges used to wear, the teachers used to wear. The idea of having a chairman of the board, the Muslim teacher would sit on a chair and the students would sit on the floor in front of him or her to learn. And that's where we get the term chairman from. So, so we don't have, so we have somebody who will go through a series of courses and they have to memorize texts. But the understanding is it's not enough to just have book learning. You also have to embody what you're learning, which is the problem with just getting a degree. These days people think like, they will think that, oh, this guy went to Harvard and studied Islamic sciences, so now he can come teach our congregation. Traditional scholars will say, no, you have to learn from a traditional teacher because your traditional teacher will never give you what's called an ijaza, a diploma, a teaching license, will never give you the teaching license until you're actually practicing what you're preaching. So your teacher is actually looking at a lot more than whether you know the correct answers to questions. So at San Ramon Valley Islamic Center, the mosque, technically we can't call it a mosque, it's an Islamic center. We don't have an imam, so like one religious spiritual leader. What we have is we have rotating imams who come, like every Friday they come to give a sermon. And we have certain imams in the community that we trust. We like the way they teach. They know how to connect with the youth. They speak English well. And so those are the ones we invite to come to our Islamic center to give the Friday sermon. The only requirement, like the way you come to worship at a church on Sunday morning, the only requirement in Islam is for the whole congregation to come on Fridays for the Friday afternoon prayer. And then the five prayers that we do a day, ideally, in the Muslim world, people would go to the local mosque, which is like literally just a few buildings down, to walk down and go pray there. But living in America, most people do their prayers at home, the five prayers. So.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Sure.
I want to thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And that satisfies your obligation to come back. So. So you can just mingle with us during our coffee hour, and we're very happy to have had you here. And I know I learned a lot. So I invite you to join hands with one another, connect in some way with one another for words of benediction. The courage of the early morning's dawning, and the strength of the eternal hills, and the peace of the evening's ending, and the love of God be in our hearts. Go in peace.